The next case on the docket is People of the State of Colorado versus Gerard Allen Pickering, case number 10-SC-446. Are both counsel ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
The case is set for an hour, half an hour to a side. Please keep track of your time, and please state your beginning of each of your argument. You may proceed, Mr. First.
May I please the court?
Good morning. For the record, my name is John First for the people. The instructions in this case, read together as a whole, satisfied due process. According to Winship, due process requires the prosecution to prove every fact necessary to establish the crime. Here, the elements instructions squarely place the burden on the prosecution to prove all the elements of reckless manslaughter. The self-defense instruction told the jury that as to reckless manslaughter, the prosecution does not bear the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense. This instruction placed no burden on the defendant to disprove reckless manslaughter or any element, particularly recklessness here, and it did nothing to relieve the prosecution of its duty to prove every fact necessary for reckless manslaughter. What the instructions, read together as a whole, permitted the jury to do, permitted the defendant to do, is to create a reasonable doubt by putting on evidence of self-defense. So, in other words, with regard to reckless manslaughter, and the legislature has said this, that self-defense is an evidence-based defense in which there is some overlap between the evidence establishing the elements and the evidence establishing the defense. But the U.S. Supreme Court, and again, that's what's happening here, is we have this overlap of evidence.
I'm going to have you just explore that overlap a little bit. You agree that self-defense negates the element of reckless, correct?
It certainly can, sure.
Yeah. Well, is it at all possible to find that the defendant acted in self-defense and also find that the defendant acted recklessly?
No, that's true.
Wait a minute, so I interrupt you. They're inconsistent, right? They're mutually exclusive. We said that in a case.
Well,
it can't be reasonable and reckless at the same time, right?
Which is why proof of recklessness refutes the reasonableness that, and actually what it is recklessness is defined as, and the prosecution has to prove and the jury has to find, that the defendant consciously disregarded an unjustifiable risk.
Right, so inversely stated, if you prove reckless, then there's no room for self-defense, correct?
That's correct. Absolutely.
So when the prosecution proves reckless, have they not disproven self-defense?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then why isn't instruction number 19, why doesn't it lower the burden of proof? Because if it's the same burden of proof, just as Justice Martinez pointed out, and you agree, well, then certainly the prosecution has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant didn't act in self-defense, because that's the very definition of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of recklessness.
The instruction put no burden on the defendant to prove anything. All it said was, and again, this is why I started my remarks, you can't take this...
Well, wait a second. Let's start out of the general principle, which you thoroughly discuss, which is certainly it's up to the legislature to determine the burden of proof with respect to self-defense. Okay. And the Martin case, except your analysis.
Among other cases, yes.
Yes. But the issue is the instruction, for me at least. Why didn't that lower the prosecution's burden? It's not a question of due process. Because the the government or the people had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the recklessness. And then on the one hand, you're saying, well, you don't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to self-defense. It's the same thing, and they're mutually exclusive. To me, that's a lowering of the burden, and I guess I'd like you to answer that.
In isolation, it's possible to read these instructions that one sentence inconsistently. But you have, but the jury didn't do that. They were instructed to read all the instructions together. And I mean, this court, I mean, to find a violation of due process, there has to be a determination that a reasonable juror would have been confused. And when you read these all these instructions together, a reasonable juror would not have been confused as to the burden of proof of the prosecution to prove the elements. And that's the violation that we established that.
What meaning does the instruction that the prosecution doesn't have to prove self-defense have? I mean, you seem to agree that it's, I think you hedged a little, maybe somewhat inconsistent. Maybe you agree it's entirely inconsistent. But I guess what I don't understand is if the self-defense instruction and the reckless instruction are inconsistent, then how is that inconsistency reconciled other than by ignoring the self-defense instruction?
I think one way to answer that is by example. And I'll take Martin, and particularly the dissent in Martin, because the instructions there were different. You had the instructions placing the burden of proof on the prosecution to prove all the elements. You had another instruction placing the burden, squarely placing the burden on the defendant to prove self-defense beyond by preponderance of the evidence. So for the dissent, and again, this is, bear in mind, this is the dissenting minority view in Martin, that those two instructions went like this, right? With, as to the jury, as to the burden. In other words, the jury sees one instruction putting the burden on the prosecution. And as to element negation, placing the burden on the defense to, in effect, negate one of the elements by establishing self-defense. And for the dissent, the fact that you had instructions placing burdens on both parties created a confusion with the jury that a reasonable juror would have found confusing. Majority rejected that. Majority said, and this is in a footnote, that In effect, we give the jury more credit than the dissent does in terms of reading these instructions. So we don't have that here. We don't have an instruction.
Mr. Frist, I understand your argument is there's no burden shifting. And it seems to be that the burden is on the prosecution for reckless. The prosecution doesn't have a burden for self-defense. No instruction says the defense has any burden. Therefore, the reconciliation is that the burden is on the prosecution to prove the elements. That's essentially your argument, correct?
When they are all read together as a whole, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. My question, however, sort of precedes and maybe overlaps with that, to use your expression. But the question is, are these instructions inconsistent? The self-defense instruction and the reckless instruction, and that both indicate, you know, and that there are conflicting notions, and one says the prosecution has the burden, the other one says the prosecution does not. Without getting to whether it shifts a burden, are those instructions inconsistent?
It's possible to read them inconsistent.
Is it possible to read them? Well, tell me how you read them in harmony. How do you say you read them together, it's not a problem. What does the self-defense instruction mean when read together with the other instructions?
It means that the jury has, that the defendant has the opportunity to create a reasonable doubt. I mean, there's no reasonable reading of with the instructions together to prevent any kind of burden on the defendant to do anything. It doesn't say that. There's no instruction to place the burden. Notwithstanding the consistency that it may have appeared to a reasonable juror in isolation, you can't just pick that one sentence out of the instruction and weigh it against and say, well, it creates this inconsistency, when all the other instructions place the burden on the prosecution to prove all the elements. And moreover, the concern in Martin was that with regard to self-defense, that the jury would certainly be able to consider evidence of self-defense. The instructions here plainly did that. The jury was not precluded from considering evidence of self-defense.
So first, if I could pick up where Justice Martinez left off, I think I understand your theory, which is that essentially this instruction allowed the jury to find reasonable doubt with respect to the recklessness element that the prosecution was required to prove.
Yes, sir.
But the instruction itself did not include the statutory language that the jury may consider the evidence of self-defense in determining whether the defendant acted recklessly.
That's correct.
But why isn't that a problem? I mean, if that's your theory, that in fact this is what the instruction led the jury to be able to do, that language doesn't appear in this instruction.
It's not a problem, again, and going back to the rest of the instructions. And I'll start with the instruction number 19, which is the instruction with this offending language. And the first sentence of that instruction is that the evidence in this case has raised the issue of self-defense. The evidence. In that same instruction, the jury is told that self-defense is a defense to reckless manslaughter. Instruction number 20, which provided the elements, instructed the jury on the elements of self-defense, just what is self-defense, reasonable belief, reasonable conduct, wasn't limited to the affirmative defense of self-defense. In other words, just it was a general definition of self-defense so that the jury could read, would understand what self-defense is. They were told it's the defense. They were told that the evidence in this case has raised the issue of self-defense. They were also told in instruction number 7 to consider all the evidence. Yes, it would have been better, of course, Your Honor, if they had given the statutory language, and that's what the legislature requires. But you know, is it a talisman? I don't think so. Given all this language and all the instructions that they were required to read together, they asked no question about any of this. The defense counsel, both parties in closing argument, emphasized self-defense. I mean, there's no. I guess I don't see how a reasonable juror could have not, in light of all the instructions, in light of counsel's argument, I don't see how they could not have considered evidence of self-defense.
First, could you just directly help me? The problem I'm really having is not necessarily a due process. Well, okay. It's maybe a variant of due process. But if the instructions are on the burden of proof are inconsistent and mutually exclusive, then how do we say that instruction number 19 does not lower the burden of proof? That's the guts of my problem. I don't have any problem with Martin and so forth. This isn't switching the burden of proof. It's lowering the burden of proof.
Okay. I understand Your Honor's distinction.
That's the question I have.
I'm broken record here, I'm afraid. But I have to go back. I go back to the fact that you can't. Any inconsistency, if at all, is all in isolation. And it's how the jurors read all those instructions, notwithstanding what may have been an inconsistency. And you know, whether the prosecution, I guess an analogy could be with when Bennett took out the old former standard on circumstantial evidence, right? Every reasonable, prosecution doesn't have to disprove every reasonable hypothesis. That's the same thing here. Just because they've proved, you know, by establishing recklessness, I mean,
Then it dealt with facts that establish the standard. Here you're saying the standard is one thing, and then the standard is not another.
Well,
on mutually exclusive things.
But it's, the analogy is that self-defense is one way to negate, possibly negate, recklessness. But certainly not, you know, not the only way, because there's other elements of recklessness. And that the prosecution has a burden to prove doesn't necessarily mean to, especially to a reasonable juror, that they can, you know, let this disproving self-defense is, like I say, necessarily inconsistent. And also, I think that in terms of harmonizing all the instructions, which again, I think is necessary to, it's not just an isolated, well, it's not a, an inconsistency that's maybe academic, but the context, the jury also would have read, did not have to prove that the defendant acted in self-defense, along with the affirmative defense of self-defense, where the prosecution did have to prove it. It's just an additional element that existed with regard to intentional crimes and did not exist with regard to unintentional crimes.
First, let me approach it this way. In your brief, you quoted the defense attorney's argument, and the quote is, if you're acting in self-defense, you are, by definition, not acting recklessly or negligently. That's why it's a complete defense, and that's why the law says if you can't get by self-defense, he's not guilty. You agree with that statement by the defense attorney in closing argument. Am I correct about that?
It would, if establishing reckless manslaughter would refute self-defense. If a defendant can create a reasonable doubt as to defense, which is, and I don't want to call it a burden because we have a specific meaning for burden, but as opportunity to create a reasonable doubt, and the defendant's done his job, and the jury acquits. That's
a yes.
That's all that's saying.
Right. So you agree with it.
In the context that I just placed it, yes.
Okay.
I think it has to.
And you also think that the jury would have understood that from the instructions of the court?
Yes.
Or do you think instead that the defense's closing argument somehow supplemented the instructions of the court?
Not to that extent, no. Not to the extent that there's any lessening of the burden, no. Absolutely not.
So they would have understood this argument of defense counsel as being accurate as a matter of law from a harmonious reading of the instructions.
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
And that's because they would have understood that the people had the burden on reckless. Correct? And as to self-defense, the people didn't have a burden, but it didn't give anyone else a burden, and so it didn't
prove,
have
right.
any legs, I guess, is what you're saying, right?
Well, and I based part of that on the fact that there were, you know, if it had been, it's so confusing, then we have to assume that the jurors were reasonable, and we have to assume that they read the instructions, were faithful to the instructions. They had no question as to these instructions. If they were as inconsistent as the court suggests, so as to lessen the prosecution's burden.
Wait a minute. I'm not hearing you say that they aren't inconsistent. What I'm hearing you say, and it's not an invalid argument, I'm just trying to understand it, is they may be inconsistent, but it doesn't place a burden on the defense. And read together, it's not so confusing as to require reversal. Isn't that what you're saying?
And that's the critical determination.
But you aren't saying, you are not claiming these instructions are consistent. You admit the inconsistency.
They can be read inconsistently. In isolation, they can be, but that's not the test. It's not the test. And there are examples in Colorado where the prosecution does not have the burden to disprove defenses that may negate an element. And one example I cite in my brief is voluntary intoxication. Now, I know in the Court of Appeals Lara case, they said that you said, right, that it was an evidentiary rule. Nonetheless, establishing intoxication negates the element, the culpable mental state, but the prosecution doesn't have the burden. Another example is alibi. The Huckleberry. I mean, we had you know, a series of cases coming up to the Court of Appeals in Huckleberry that said alibi was an affirmative defense. Huckleberry says, this court said, no, it's not. It's not, because alibi does not require proof or disproof of factual issues beyond those necessary to establish the elements of the offense charged. In other words,
Mr. Fish, your argument now is the prosecution does not have the burden to disprove self-defense and the jury should not be so instructed. But that's a little bit different than telling them the instruction that was given here, isn't it?
It is.
Okay.
But I guess all I'm saying is that this is, you know, in terms of the burden, the prosecution, I mean, the language of the instruction was correct. I mean, it was correct under Colorado law. The real issue, as we've been discussing mostly, really comes down, Justice Bender, as you said, it really isn't due process in terms of what Colorado can and cannot do, what the legislature appropriately did in 7044. The issue is whether this instruction, this language, this one sentence, so confused a reasonable juror that it would have lessened the burden. And for all the reasons that I've said, it could not have confused even one juror. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Hardman, registration number 37922, and I represent Jared Pickering. In Colorado, the prosecution always bears the burden of disproving defenses raised by the evidence, regardless of the type of defense. Neither the United States nor the Colorado constitutions allow the burden to be shifted to the defendant to prove defenses that negate an element of the defense, of the offense. Because self-defense requires that a defendant act in a reasonable manner, self-defense negates the mens rea element of reckless manslaughter. So the prosecution necessarily must disprove self-defense in proving the element of recklessness. Like the defenses of alibi or consent, the prosecution must disprove the defense that negates the corresponding element of the charged offense. In alibi or consent cases, the defendant is not entitled to a special instruction. Here in this context, the statute mandates that the defendant is entitled to a self-defense instruction. And that makes sense because the relationship between self-defense and recklessness isn't obvious. It may be obvious to us after years of case law interpreting the legal relationship between the two.
Excuse me, Ms. Hardman.
Yes.
I didn't quite. What is it that you say the statute entitles the defendant to? Yeah.
Part 4 of the self-defense statute says, the court, if the defendant presents evidence of self-defense, the court shall instruct the jury with the self-defense law instruction.
I see. You mean a definitional instruction, right?
Right. The court shall instruct the jury that it may consider the evidence of self-defense.
Okay, that wasn't on the second sentence, but the first was, right? Right?
Excuse me?
The statute was only partially complied with in this case.
Right.
The self-defense definitional instruction was given, but the second, or I don't know if it's the third sentence, the point that Justice Mark has made.
Yes.
Was that challenged at any point, that the omission of that language?
No, the defense attorney submitted their own instructions, defense tendered instruction 4 and 5, which explained the relationship, and said that if you find the defendant acted in self-defense, you have to find not guilty, but it didn't quote verbatim the language from the statute either, no. The relationship between self-defense and recklessness, it's taken years of case law to get out this, the relationship, the legal relationship between these two concepts. It would not be obvious to the lay people, jurors, who receive these instructions in this case. And even in the cases of alibi and consent, and especially here, it's erroneous and lowers the prosecution's burden of proof to affirmatively tell the jury that the prosecution does not have the burden of disproving those defenses that negate an element of the crime. Here, the jury was instructed that the prosecution did not bear the burden of disproving self-defense with respect to reckless manslaughter. The instruction misled the jury about the prosecution's burden of proof and appeared to put the burden on Mr. Pickering of proving that he did not, or proving that he acted in self-defense.
Can I interrupt you there? Because I'm looking at the instruction 19, which instructs the jury both on the affirmative self-defense and then self-defense in the context of recklessness. And it seems right there on that same page that with respect to the affirmative self-defense, the prosecution does bear the burden of proving beyond reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense. And then on the second half of that same page makes clear that the burden is different when we're talking about self-defense in the context of reckless manslaughter. So wouldn't that juxtaposition sort of make clear to the jury the difference between the two?
I think it makes it very unclear. It says, self-defense is an affirmative defense to these crimes. It's also a defense to reckless manslaughter, but not an affirmative defense, assuming the jury is going to understand what that means. And then that is, the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant did not act in self-defense with respect to these charges. And if the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of disproving self-defense, well then, who bears the burden? It must be Mr. Pickering, is how the jury would understand that.
Ms. Harmon, may I ask a question? How would you then instruct the jury so they'd understand the prosecution's different burden with regard to an affirmative defense and a traverse, which in effect self-defense is here with regard to recklessness?
In People v. Law, the Court of Appeals proposes an instruction. And it should explain, and, you know, you could use that instruction there, but I think the instruction should explain the relationship between the two.
Let me phrase it this way so I just don't leave you hanging there. You would agree, I guess, that the prosecution has an additional and different burden with regard to an affirmative defense. That is, it not only has to prove the elements of the offense, but in addition to that, it has to do something more. It has to disprove the affirmative defense, which would excuse the commission of those elements.
It becomes an additional element, right?
But when in effect, the defense is merely a traverse, that is, it would negate one of the elements, then the prosecution doesn't have an additional burden. It simply has to prove the elements. The problem is we don't want to confuse them and make them feel that the prosecution is being relieved of that burden to prove the elements. But at the same time, we don't want to make them feel that it has to do something in addition to proving those elements. When you have a situation like this, in which back-to-back, the jury is presented with the defense of self-defense as an affirmative defense, which requires something in addition to proving the elements, and also as a traverse, how should we instruct them such that we don't over-create a burden and we don't under-create a burden?
They should be explained the relationship between reasonableness of self-defense and recklessness of reckless manslaughter. Explained how the two are related. Self-defense in this context would not be an additional element, as in like in an affirmative defense instruction. They should be explained that the reasonableness is bound up in part of the finding of recklessness, that in finding recklessness, they necessarily find not reasonableness. And that how the two are related that way. It's part of the same burden. They need to be instructed to evaluate the recklessness mens rea element. They need to understand the relationship between recklessness and self-defense, and that's all the instruction needs to explain.
Would it have been proper to say, we just instructed you that with regard to murder and, you know, whatever it was, second degree murder and assault and whatever, that the prosecution has the burden of proving, in addition to the elements, disproving self-defense. But that's not true with regard to crimes of recklessness. With regard to crimes of recklessness, it doesn't have any additional burden. It only has to prove the element.
It's part of the element that the reasonableness.
Do you think that instruction tendered by the defense in this case accomplished that purpose?
Instruction 5 is better than instruction 4. It accurately states the burden of proof. The prosecution bears the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant did not act in self-defense.
Does that explain that there's a difference between proving that in addition to the elements of the offense, or that it is simply the prosecution accomplishes that by proving the elements of the offense?
The last part of his instruction says, a person who acts in self-defense does not act recklessly or with criminal negligence. With respect to these charges, the defendant does not bear the burden of proving that he acted in self-defense. And so it does explain the relationship between the two. Excuse me. I'm sorry, I thought you were starting to say something.
I think she was just interrupting my question.
I'm just having an allergy attack.
Could I ask you a question? I don't have it in front of me, but in terms of the element instructions, when the judge explains what the elements are, in this particular case, that the judge defined the various elements of each crime as the prosecution has to prove these. Usually it reads the prosecution has to prove these factors, A, B, C, D, whatever they are, and disprove the affirmative defense of. And usually that is the language which is used. And the reason I'm asking that is because that would introduce the concept of an affirmative defense and the element instructions to the jury right up front, long before jury 19 or whatever it is, instruction 19 that we're talking about.
Let me turn there.
I would be surprised if that weren't the case, since that's pretty much standard form. And then when we got down to the element instructions for these lessers, we would have the same kind of same kind of organization, but the whole concept of an affirmative defense would be left out. And then 19, I see it as kind of a summary or almost a carrying instruction, which just sort of summarizes for the jury what has to have been these element instructions earlier in the packet.
Instruction 14 defines the elements of second-degree murder, and it has, without the affirmative defense, in instruction number 19. And then instruction 15 is the elements of reckless manslaughter, which does not include the affirmative defense
language. So 14 and 15 would have introduced those concepts before 19. And 19 then seems to be, at least to my way of thinking, without looking at the entire packet, almost a summary instruction where it's talking in general. We have these four kinds of crimes where there are affirmative defenses, and I'm going to tell you that when there are affirmative defenses, the prosecution has a burden. And then there are these, what is it, three or four kinds of crimes where there are not affirmative defenses, although there still is the question of self-defense. And I'm going to tell you that the prosecution doesn't have a burden in those kinds of cases, but nothing more.
It's not a summary. It adds this concept of the prosecution not bearing the burden of proof with respect to that element, and the jury is not properly informed about what recklessness means. It's conflicting.
Would have had to have been properly informed about what reckless means somewhat earlier in the packet when there were definition of those mens rea kinds of terms.
But this instruction takes self-defense out of their consideration. It says the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense with respect to these charges. It takes it completely away. And so the jury's finding of recklessness is unreliable because of this instruction, which is confusing, misleading as to the burden of proof.
Could you just read me the elemental instruction for reckless manslaughter?
For reckless manslaughter, it's instruction 15. The elements of reckless manslaughter are, number one, that the defendant, number two, in the state of Colorado at or about the date and place charged, three, recklessly, four, caused the death of Leon Villarreal.
That's it.
There has to be a definition of recklessness.
And the definition of reckless would have come earlier, yes. I would assume. It's where they're usually organized.
Right.
And read us the definition of reckless, please.
Okay. That's in number 13. A person acts recklessly when he consciously disregards a substantial and unjustified risk that a result will occur or that a circumstance exists.
So we're telling the jury that that mental state has to exist in order to find someone to have acted recklessly. And then if you do so, then the prosecution has proven that case, proven that that crime or that charge. And then in 19, you're saying, we're still talking about self-defense, because that's what the very first sentence says, but oh, incidentally, the prosecution now doesn't have it to disprove it. There's no affirmative defense here.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question. But are you asking about the difference between the elemental of reckless manslaughter and an...
Well, I'm trying to get us to start reading these instructions as a whole, as opposed to just focusing on 19. Because the way these instructions are always organized is that we have the kind of the definitional terms, if you will, defined, and then we have the elements which use those definitional terms. And this instruction 19, I haven't really seen one quite like it, or I didn't use one quite like it when I was a trial judge, but that's why I'm seeing it as kind of a summary sort of an instruction where you put all of these things together to try to create a juxtaposition between what the prosecution has to do in one kind of crime and what the prosecution doesn't have to do in another kind of crime.
Well, it's not a summary because it adds this additional language.
Right.
And read as a whole, the instructions are conflicting and confusing. And if we have to have an hour-long conversation about what it means, I doubt the lay people, jurors, are going to be understanding what it means. And especially how the mens rea element is relating to the reasonableness of self-defense, it's unclear, and this instruction lowers the prosecution's burden of proof and shifts that burden to Mr. Pickering.
Would it have, would it have satisfied you, do you think, if where the instruction says the prosecution, this is not an affirmative defense, you know, with regard to reckless, the bottom part of 19, and then it says the prosecution does not bear the burden of proving, which, of course, is in juxtaposition to up above where it says the prosecution does bear the burden.
Mm-hmm.
There obviously is a difference between the two. You're mm-hmm. saying the second one doesn't express fully what that difference is and really minimizes. Would it satisfy, you think, if there it said not only the prosecution doesn't bear the burden, but it said the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of disproving self-defense in addition to proving the elements of the offense? Would that have made it all right?
If I understand your question correctly, no, because they have to be properly informed. Because saying the prosecution does not bear the burden of proving self-defense, they do, because it's part of proving recklessness, just like in alibi.
But you would agree it's not something in addition to proving recklessness. And it seems to me that's the heart of what we're dealing with here in the difference between a traverse and an affirmative defense. What do we say to the jury to let them know the prosecution has satisfied its burden completely if it proves the elements?
But they need to be explained what that element of recklessness means.
But they were explained what that element of reckless means earlier when they were given the definitions, and then they were explained what had to be proven, and they saw the juxtaposition in terms of the element instructions between the earlier crimes where the prosecution had the burden of disproving something, an affirmative defense, and the later crimes where there was no such requirement. So I guess I'm finding it frustrating that you're focusing only on 19 without reading this as a packet as a whole.
I am reading them as a whole. And as a whole, they're conflicting and confusing. And this lowers the prosecution's burden of proof. They're told the prosecution bears the burden of proving recklessness, but wait, no, they don't bear the burden of disproving self-defense, when those two things are bound up together and in a mutually exclusive way. And so to instruct that they don't bear the burden of disproving self-defense lowers their burden of proof.
I guess if I'm understanding the conversation up here and with you, that tension seems to arise between the notion that when the prosecution proves recklessness, it inherently disproves reasonableness, which would be part of self-defense. Do you agree with that?
If they're properly instructed.
Well, if the prosecution meets its burden and proves recklessness beyond a reasonable doubt, has it not thereby inherently disproved the self-defense? Because the self-defense would be based on reasonableness, and the two are inherently inconsistent.
Not when they're instructed that self-defense, that they don't have the burden of proving self-defense. They're not properly instructed on what recklessness means, so their finding of recklessness is unreliable.
Putting the instructions to one side, I'm just trying to tackle what exactly is the burden of proof and how you perceive it. Do you agree that proof of recklessness would, by a matter of logic, disprove reasonableness?
Yes.
Okay.
They have to be instructed.
So there's not something over and above that the prosecution necessarily has to prove, because if it does, in fact, prove recklessness, it has thereby disproved reasonableness.
Well, they still have to prove that the defendant did not act in self-defense, and I think the statute says that. In a case in which the defendant is not entitled to a jury instruction regarding self-defense as an affirmative defense, the court shall allow the defendant to present evidence that he or she was acting in self-defense. If the defendant presents evidence of self-defense, the court shall instruct the jury with a self-defense law instruction. The court shall instruct the jury that it may consider the evidence of self-defense in determining whether the defendant acted recklessly. However, the self-defense law instruction shall not be an affirmative defense, and then it has the language from instruction 19, which is bad. But I think what it means there in saying, in adding self-defense law instruction shall not be an affirmative defense, that just means, like we've been talking about, it's not a separate element. It's part of the finding of recklessness, and the jury needs to be told or explained how, explained the relationship. It's not like alibi and consent where you can say the relationship is so obvious they don't need an instruction. Here the legislature says you have to have an instruction to explain that relationship.
Let me ask you, you've mentioned this a couple of times about alibi. Why is that different with regard to alibi? Question of alibi, alibi is saying I was somewhere else. I didn't commit the crime, I was somewhere else. If you prove the defendant committed all the elements of the crime, you have disproved alibi. Is that not true? You don't, and wasn't that the point of Huckleberry? Therefore, it's a mistake to instruct the jury that in addition to proving he committed the elements of the crime, you have to also prove that, disprove his alibi. Yeah. You've done that at the same time. Isn't that basically the same situation we have here?
I don't think it's a mistake to instruct the jury that way, but that you don't have to instruct the jury that way because that relationship is obvious. But here in this context, you do have to give an instruction. And even in alibi, it would be erroneous to say the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of disproving alibi because it is part of that element, and that's what happened here.
Do you run down for me your argument, not about the lowering of the burden of proof, but why it shifts the burden? Because I'm not sure I just understand that.
Because it says the prosecution does not bear the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant did not act in self-defense with respect to these charges. If the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of proving defendant did not act in self-defense, then necessarily Mr. Pickering did have to prove that he acted in self-defense. If the prosecution doesn't bear the burden, well, then who does? Who's the only other person at the table? It's Mr. Pickering.
But why wouldn't that just be subsumed under the general reasonable doubt burden of proof stuff? I mean, there's plenty of facts that go to establish, failure to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Could you ask your question?
Yeah, I don't understand. I guess I don't see you're making the necessary corollary that if it says the prosecution doesn't have the burden, that automatically assumes the defendant does, right? And I'm saying, why isn't that just another fact, like anything else, which goes to the prosecution's, maybe the jury would find just the prosecution failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt whatever the crime was.
Because self-defense in this context is an element negating defense. And in proving recklessness, they have to disprove self-defense, that he acted reasonably in self-defense.
So that, you think, results in a shifting of the burden of proof. That's the issue I'm trying to get at. I understand your argument about reasonableness and risk and so forth. And it makes some sense to me. But the burden of shifting of the burden of proof, I don't quite get.
If the prosecution doesn't bear the burden, which is how they were instructed, the jurors are going to understand Mr. Pickering bears the burden.
I mean, it seems to me that instruction would read more like defendant has the burden of proving self-defense. I mean, that would clearly shift the burden of proof. But I don't think this instruction necessarily goes quite that far. It just says that the prosecution doesn't bear that burden. And so is your argument essentially that the jurors necessarily made an inferential leap, that in fact the burden then fell on the defendant, even in the absence of that language?
It's not that much of a leap when you're told the prosecution doesn't bear the burden of proving defendant didn't act in self-defense. Who does bear the burden?
The jury was instructed that the prosecution bears a burden of proof beyond reasonable doubt of all the elements of the crime.
As to recklessness, but then they are not properly instructed on what recklessness means. in relationship to self-defense. They're told this instruction takes self-defense out of their consideration, and their finding of recklessness doesn't mean anything in the context of this case. I just briefly wanted, we haven't talked about Martin v. Ohio, and I think Martin v. Ohio is a distraction, and I've explained that in the brief, how it's distinguishable from this case in two very important ways. So I think it makes sense why the Court of Appeals hasn't addressed Martin v. Ohio. And I don't think it makes sense to try to attach us to this dissent that we've never tried, talked about. And if you have any questions about why it's distinguishable, I'd be happy to answer them. I also wanted to respond to the intoxication questions. Intoxication is different from these element negating defenses, because intoxication is not always an element negating defense. An intoxicated person can form specific intent. And in footnote 13, this court said it's not an element negating defense. But in this context, self-defense is always an element negating defense, because a person can never act both recklessly and reasonably in self-defense at the same time. So in these element negating defenses, alibi, consent, here self-defense, it's erroneous and lowers the prosecution's burden of proof to affirmatively tell the jury the prosecution does not bear the burden of proving, disproving the defense that, I'm sorry, it came out. It's erroneous to affirmatively tell the jury the prosecution does not have the burden of disproving the defense that negates the element of the crime. And here, the instruction misled the jury about the prosecution's burden of proof, misinstructed them about what recklessness meant, and was confusing, even when read with the other instructions. Accordingly, we ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision.
Thank you for your argument. First, rebuttal.
You've raised an interesting question on how do we instruct the jury in this context.
Oh, what about just leaving that piece out?
Well, that's...
It seems like it is confusing.
Yes, Your Honor, of course. I mean, and
you know, the legislature... If you sat down and read it, you wouldn't understand it, right?
The legislature made that decision. And the only thing in the statute that they said was instruct the jury that they can consider evidence of self-defense with regard to determining culpable mental states of unintentional culpable mental states. They didn't say, and we admit that, of course, that legislature did not say give that last sentence that was given here. I mean, it's there, and this is not the first time it's happened. So, certainly out of this opinion, you need to say that stop giving that sentence. And then what do we do? Well, the legislature, I think, made the decision just give that self-defense law instruction about considering the evidence. Clearly, law is wrong in suggesting that we treat it in the instructions as an affirmative defense, so that it becomes an additional element without the affirmative defense of yourself.
So first,
because it's redundant.
In reflecting about what the appropriate instruction might be, I wonder if I could have the benefit of your thoughts on whether it's a different situation in terms of what the appropriate instruction is, depending upon whether you're dealing with a crime such as this one, where by itself that is, where reckless is the only mens rea with which you are concerned, versus this case, where you actually have also crimes where self-defense is an affirmative defense. In other words, to what extent is the confusing problem that you're also, that you also have self-defense as an affirmative defense in the same case?
I think where recklessness is the lead charge in the charged offense, it's probably easier, of course. I think you just, you give the evidentiary instruction that the legislature recommended and be done with it. In this context, is Justice Rice is calling the summary instruction, I think that's why this is not a, it's certainly not a pattern instruction. And, most of the, well, the instructions conference was not on the record. All that was on the record was just reading his tendered instructions into the record, and that's it. So we don't know what motivated this summary instruction. I mean, I think part of it has to be that it's based on the instructions that the defense tendered, because some of 19 was taken from one of the defense tendered instructions. In that it was self-defense is also defense. We're not arguing by error here. I don't think that's the case. But interestingly, Justice Martinez, I mean the majority in Martin kind of looked at what the dissent was saying and attributed to the dissent as saying that no instruction would satisfy the dissent. So the Supreme Court is with this as well. I didn't suggest an instruction. Possibly. The question really, really comes down to, is clarification necessary beyond just instructing the jury that it can consider evidence of self-defense? Possibly. I don't disagree that the last sentence in the defense tendered, the second of the defense tendered instructions, that the defendant does not bear the burden of proving self-defense, may clarify, but at the same time, sometimes we're giving the jury too much information.
In that respect, although it may be inaccurate in an academic sense to say that the prosecution has the burden to disprove self-defense.
It does have the burden to disprove
self-defense.
Yes, I agree.
I'm sorry. Yeah, let me just start over.
Please.
I understand that at least an academic sense, it would be inaccurate to instruct the jury that the prosecution on this reckless manslaughter has the burden to disprove self-defense. However, if you instructed the jury that, wouldn't that be the simplest way to do this? There would be no harm from that. There would be no additional burden on the prosecution.
It really does create an additional burden.
What's the additional burden? I mean, you earlier, when I questioned you, admitted that these don't just overlap, they're inconsistent. What's the additional burden? Prove self-defense by proving reckless. Where's the additional burden? And it sort of seems to me the confusion is all ours as we try to understand how the defenses operate. From the jury perspective, it's really fairly simple.
Well, see, that's why I have to respond. The defense counsel argues that it's only obvious to lawyers, not obvious to the jury. Well, I mean, that cuts the other way as well. If it's not obvious, they're not doing all this wrangling. They're not here. They're not here arguing this. They're not here writing the briefs. They're not here thinking about this. They're looking at this as a reasonable jury would, and that reasonable jury would juxtapose the affirmative defense with the non-affirmative defense and see it as an additional burden. Okay, we just look at the elements. I mean, so You know, and again, I go back to the fact that Huckleberry clearly says it's not necessary. You know, we don't want to instruct that way.
Fuzz? We don't want to instruct that way. I guess, I mean, one of the ways of looking at this, if you were a trial prosecutor, if you were a trial prosecutor, why would you want any of these instructions in there? Get rid of all this appellate argument. Simply tell the jury that the prosecution has to disprove self-defense. Prosecution has no additional burden, and the defense has no appellate issues to raise. Isn't that a lot simpler?
I just think there's a potential. There's still a potential for confusion with the jury when they see, because we do treat it differently. It's redundancy that the jury doesn't have to, it won't create confusion. And thank you.
I want to thank both attorneys for their argument. The case will be submitted on the briefs.